The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
Back here for another episode of the Midwest Swing Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We're part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha on Twitter and Zone Coverage at Zone Coverage MN. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon underscore WARNE. And producing today, as he has been for pretty much every show we've done now for quite some time, is the co-founder of Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage, Tom Schreier, at TSchreier3. Tom, how are you doing?
Doing well. I'm fatigued after covering two really long baseball games recently.
Yeah, and I suspect our guest today is going to feel the same way. Not only was there the marathon 15-inning game on Sunday, but also yesterday's debacle at Target Field. Let's just bring him in. Mike Berardino, St. Paul Pioneer Press. How are we doing today?
Not fatigued at all, Brandon. I'm ready to go. I'm energized by the historic occasions that we witnessed, Tom and I, the last couple of days.
Yeah, the hashtag Raindance Schreier comes up whenever it starts raining.
They're going to ban me from the press box.
And so not only was there a brief rain delay yesterday, how long was that rain delay?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. Probably the shortest one of all time. Then the Twins ended up having a debacle of, I believe, what was it, 14 runs in the final two innings. Is that right, Mike?
Yes. Amazing.
I'm going to write a column on it today, assuming I have time between now and when the clubhouse opens and when things start going on at Target Field, in defense of Paul Molitor's bullpen management. Everyone was upset that he didn't use Jason Wheeler or Drew Rusinski in the eighth inning. To me, he used Drew Rusinski in the ninth once the game was out of control, which I think was the plan all along. I just think that the process actually was better than people are giving credit for. You know, with hindsight, you want to look at the process after the fact. And I think the idea behind Jason Wheeler coming up and Drew Rusinski, who has since been sent back for Buddy Beauchere's, was they could give you length. Now, were they going to give you length in a game started by Irvin Santana? Probably not. Jose Berríos? Maybe. But I don't think it makes sense. There's more people than I can even believe suggesting that Jason Wheeler should have made his big league debut with a 6-run lead in the eighth inning. How are you walking back when you look at that inning and how Paul Molitor managed it?
Well, I don't think I disagree with you on that. I think that it is, first of all, never a good strategy to play the result.
Right.
That's the easiest thing in the world. So that's, you know, Molitor was asked one point-blank question about why not use the new call-ups after the game and in the eighth, and he answered it diplomatically, which he always does, but other managers might have exploded after a couple of tough days like that. You see, Drew Rusinski's been up here before. One other time he pitched in mop-up. They were both up here to handle potential mop-up situations. You could argue that in many cases a 6-run lead with 6 outs to go would have been precisely the time, at least for Wheeler, just to see, I don't know, the fact that the Astros are so potent and that they are, by record, the best team in baseball, and they showed, again, for everyone just how quickly they can take over a game. I thought he was playing the cards in the proper order because he did not have certain people at his disposal. It was a gassed bullpen, as we all know. Duffy was not available, it would appear. Kinsler probably not available, although maybe if it got to the ninth. Presley was not overused, as you pointed out on Twitter. He'd worked 3 out of 4, but that became 3 out of 4 days. That's not unreasonable for anybody. It really, the one guy they have to stay away from 3 in a row even is Belial, and it did not go well for him, but that was not 3 in a row.
I do have a question about Matt Belial. Do you have any sense that that the Twins are wearing thin on patience with him?
Not yet. I don't get that sense, but, you know, this is a guy who missed a good bit of time last year due to injury in the first half with a calf and then a forearm deal, and, he's up there in age and mid-30s, and it's been hard for him to complete a full season since he's left Colorado. He was pretty darn durable in Colorado, but these last couple of years, Nationals and Cardinals, it's been a case where he's needed a break at some point. It wouldn't shock me if I have no reason, other than just the pattern the last couple of years, I have no reason to think that he's pitching through anything, but all bullpen guys are pitching through something at some point. Wouldn't surprise me if he got a little breather on the DL at some point, especially with just the 10-day stint these days. When it goes bad for him, he has very razor-thin margin for error. He's a, he's a pitchability reliever. He's a location-first and beat you with his brain reliever, and then sometimes he gets his brains beat in because of that.
He almost reminds me of Matt Guerrero a little bit.
I'd see some of that. I think he's got a better idea of his arsenal. I like Matt Guerrero. I thought he was interesting to talk pitching with, and I thought he had a very calming presence in there. Not just the first name. That's a good comparison. I think Belial's stuff's a little better, believe it or not. I think that he also is showing these guys when he's right and when he's successful. And he gave him 2 innings, very good innings, with 4 strikeouts day before that meltdown. But what he can operate in the upper levels of the strike zone. Taylor Rogers is talking to me about that, that he has gone to school a little bit, even though it's a lefty-righty thing. Mm-hmm. He just has learned what can be done with a fastball that's put just high enough in the hitting zone to be tempting but also difficult to do damage. Carlos Beltran did not have that problem.
Well, and keep in mind, too, that his damage that has come against him has all been concentrated to, like, I think it's like the span of 1 1/3 innings where he's allowed something like 15 or 14 of the earned runs he's put up this year. And, again, I think that the prevailing fan sentiment is to throw money at the bullpen. You got to address the bullpen, which we've seen in myriad ways is not really a good take. You can get the Antonio Bastardos and Tony Sipps of the world. Maybe you land on a Sean Kelly every now and then. But teams building bullpens through free agency typically are not successful. Everyone's so upset that the Twins opted to pay for Matt Belial when, in fact, a 1-year deal to a reliever is defensible. And if anybody saw this coming, they're out of their minds. Because, and I tweeted this yesterday, this year, 17 earned runs. The last 2 years combined, 19 earned runs in 79.2 innings. So, again, I know he's 36 going on 37, but if fans are going to play the, well, I saw this coming because of results game, I'm going to call their bluff every single time.
Once again, I think you're speaking sense here, and that's a little scary to admit that. But I will say that, yeah, I'm with you. I think the bullpen guys, they're because the sample size is smaller, and this especially goes for lefties, as you pointed out, the likes of Boone Logan.
Oh, yeah,
are
somebody wanted
so
Boone
lightly
Logan.
Used.
Yeah.
These are not panaceas in any regard in the free agent market. If anything, they're booby traps because they're just look at it. They basically toggle from good to bad in many cases. It's very hard to it's much better to catch a Fernando Abad on the upswing after a bad year and then flip them as they did. Unfortunately, they flipped them for Pat Light, so nothing good came of it. But he was really good for a couple of months. That was a Terry Ryan signing, by the way. The same goes for a Matt Belial. Actually, I thought Matt Belial was a pretty astute signing coming, even though the stuff isn't going to wow anybody. But as you said, he's basically been very good for half a season for each of the last 2 years. He needs to get that sort of they cannot overuse him. The guy you worry about, even though he's very young in terms of overusage right now, is Taylor Rogers. But he's getting the Aaron Thompson treatment a little bit. But
yeah,
take the ball, Taylor. I will say that, no, I'm with you. I do not like just look at it. The Dodgers could spend anything they want, right? The Dodgers and the Yankees, but especially the Dodgers. Look, they could just go out there and just line up $6 million a year relievers or more and then have a $15 million closer, which they have.
Mm-hmm.
But they delight, it seems, in finding those undervalued assets, those guys making the minimum in many cases, in their bullpen, because they realize, Andrew Friedman and all the former GMs that he has at his disposal, they realize that even with basically unlimited resources, it's still wisest to try to look for the inefficiencies in the market and to find a guy who maybe there's something in the spin rate, something in the medical report, something in the luck stats, the FIP, the XFIP, whatever, coming. These things will normalize for relievers year to year in a way that they don't for starters as readily, because starters are getting a chance, if healthy, to throw 180 to 200 innings a year, 160 to 180. These relievers who are throwing in an injury-marred year, you know, maybe 40, 50 innings, those are the guys that are more likely to pan out. So you're not going to need to spend big for those, and to guarantee 3 or 4 years now to the likes of Brett Cecil, not a good play, and especially not a good play if your salary structure is what the what it is for the Twins.
Well, and let's call it that they're looking for the pre-6 fix. They're looking for guys that are not free agent eligible yet that they can control as long as they're good, jettison when they're bad or get hurt, which happens to probably 50% of all relievers. And it's just giving multiple years to relievers is a scary proposition because, I mean, look at Chapman. He's been hurt this year. Jansen has been healthy, but if you were to pick one or the other, you'd be picking a name out of a hat, and you could have picked wrong quite easily. So, to me, you know, bullpens are tricky. It's failed starters, it's young guys, it's an old guy every now and then. And the thing about that, too, is I think they went into the offseason knowing they wanted single-year relievers. That means you got to wait out the market and see who's left. Would you maybe have liked a Fernando Salas instead? Maybe. But at the same time, it's just a matter of who's going to sign with you, who's going to go sign for 1 year so that you aren't stuck with 3 years where you could, in theory, block a healthy Nick Birdie, a Jake Reed or whatever, or you'd be stuck paying them and trying to justify their usage at that time. So I really don't have a problem with identifying Matt Belisle as one of those guys. And so I don't know.
And let's give him credit for Breslow at this point. I mean, it could still blow up, and I know that he gets charged with runs yesterday, but that play needs to be made, and a reasonable veteran or a normal outfielder probably makes that play. Mm-hmm. It was an athletic play. Adrianza gave it a nice run, but a little bit much to ask of a guy who's played 3 games there in AAA and a couple of games in spring training with the Giants. But if Molitor had taken away his given up his DH with 9 outs to go and thrown Grossman in right and moved Kepler over to center and Rosario's still in left, that play gets made.
Right. I do want to go back to Boone Logan for just a second, too. The thing about him is I think he's the icing on the cake. He's not the flour or the sugar. And so the reason that the Indians were lauded for signing him, and I believe he got a one-year deal with an option, was that his presence allows Tito to be more diplomatic about when he uses Miller. That way, in the sixth inning, if you've got a tough lefty matchup, let's just say Joe Mauer in his prime or even Joe Mauer this month, you can use Logan there and then save Miller for facing Mauer in the eighth. The ability to mix and match, he enhances a bullpen, but you're not bringing in Boone Logan to pitch an eighth inning with 3 righties coming up like they even did with Taylor Rogers back in Camden Yards the other day. So, honestly, it's fool's gold to look at Boone Logan with 11 strikeouts per nine, pitching 66 times but 38 innings or whatever it is. There's just no way he makes the Twins' bullpen that much better to the point where someone should be yelling at me on Twitter about them not signing Boone Logan.
Yeah, I agree. And one thing, too, is that we'll see if this changes over time. But, the whole loogie thing, you know, Terry Ryan never wanted loogies. He wanted people who could get righties and lefties out. They actually, in Taylor Rogers, pretty much have a straight loogie, although he's gotten much better at handling right-handers this
year.
His splits are
weird for now, but he doesn't really think that's something he's been working on. It's just kind
of throughout. I mean, we've had years of data going back to his starting days in the minors where he's dominated lefties, struggled with righties.
Yep.
There's a reason that he's not starting anymore. It's because the changeup never came around and the righties saw him too well. Whatever, he is learning to pitch inside more and, again, to use the top quadrant of the strike zone more. And I love the fearlessness. He's going to have a nice long career.
Mm-hmm.
Breslow is showing them how to get by with substandard stuff and pure guile. And you see him out there. You look out there. I mean, he's constantly talking to somebody just during the game. I mean, Greg Breslow, for what they're getting him at, what was it, $1.25 million with incentives?
Yeah.
He's almost worth that if he's just a second bullpen coach with all the knowledge that's in that head. And then he comes in and he gets on a streak like this and he's stranded a number of his inherited runs. He's stranded 9 of 11 until yesterday. So yesterday was weird, you know, the rain and the misplays in the outfield. And I had no problem with Brian Presley with that stuff, and he is tantalizing. He knows it. He should be way better. Mulder knows it. I mean, the plan was that Presley wouldn't remember the things we were saying about him going into the year, that not only would he start the year in the eighth, but at some point he might be so good that they'd be tempted to flip him and Kinsler, because Presley with the swing and miss and the high end stuff is certainly profiles as your more typical closer. It would not have shocked anyone if he'd already been elevated to closer by now. Instead, he's mostly been demoted to the sixth or seventh because of his lack of confidence and some poor location, and then some poor luck too, some opposite field stuff that leaves you shaking your head. But still, I mean, he's able to run it up there when he's ticked off, you know, 99, and the slider will still come in there 90, 92. And he's got the slow curveball too, and
a really good one too.
Yeah, so you're up six runs, and you put Ryan Presley in the game. I'm pretty sure the win probability at that point, considering what, if you factor the stuff into it, if you want, if you can do that, was very, very high. And just a weird day. Of course, this bullpen too, as I pointed out on TwinCities.com, it is, you know, there have been three extreme failures for the bullpen at Texas, at home against Boston, and then yesterday. And if you, those three were 36 total earned runs off of that group. Now, you can't play this game. You can't subtract those. But if you could, magically, or if you just want to talk about all the other games except those three, they have the fifth best bullpen ERA in the game. The failures have been so concentrated. And keep in mind, once you're behind by a certain point, they would have left Drew Rosinski out there if they had to for another 10 earned runs, possibly. It was that kind of day, as long as the pitch count didn't get out of line.
The Braves did that the other day with Josh Colemanter.
And he's been pretty highly valued as a swingman over the years. So these things can certainly get out of whack. I'm not saying that this is a shutdown, amazing, top five bullpen. I'm just saying that if you subtract those three complete glitches, then they would be fifth in the game in ERA, not in strikeout rate and all the other things you want to look at, ground ball rate, Kinsler aside, and maybe some others. But there's nothing wrong with trying to cobble together your bullpen around a few relative givens, because that's when you can spread those funds around to the rest of the team. That's what it takes to spread those funds around to the rest of the team. So they've hit on Tyler Duffy at this point as a conversion guy, as we talked about on your show a number of times last year. That made too much sense.
Yep.
To take a guy who, what do they keep complaining about with Tyler Duffy last year? Well, the changeup's not where it needs to be. He gets too amped up and emotional to handle the three times through the lineup. They see him well by the third time, they're hitting him, whatever. All those things, I mean, even I could figure out, even I was asking by the end of last year, why don't you just put Duffy in the bullpen and May in the rotation? And that was exactly what they flipped going into this year. Unfortunately, Trevor May got hurt.
So, yeah, the win probability on Fangraphs, 99.1% for the Twins after seven innings, 97.8% after the eighth to lose. So your point is well taken there. I do have to ask you, how was Ryan Presley's temperament after the game yesterday?
Great, considering. There have been moments this year where he has He's left before speaking, and I don't think he'll do that anymore. He gets it. He has talked about that sort of thing, the responsibility that comes with bullpen failure, even if you're not the only one that failed in the bullpen. And future closers need to stand before the microphones. It only takes about 90 seconds, and that's what it took yesterday. And he used the words embarrassing a few times, and that was the right word. And he wasn't angry. He wasn't snippy. I thought he handled it great. And somebody needed to speak. It's interesting, though, Matt Belisle, who is very well-spoken and definitely behind the scenes, has delivered all sorts of wisdom to those guys, the younger guys especially, doesn't speak much, doesn't get quoted much. I talked to him here and there, and certainly have written features about him during the spring, but I thought maybe we'd see more of when there's a collective bullpen face plant, that Belisle would be the one to come out there and take it. But I think part of the learning process is he's almost coaching up the guys like Presley to handle those questions, and it's pretty painless once you get out there.
Well, and yeah, he's the corner locker guy, so you'd think he'd kind of be the
he
guy
can slip right out, but I don't think he's slipping right out. I think he's purposely letting these other guys handle it, and maybe, you know, for all I know, Matt Belisle is watching the video of the actual thing, and he's telling him, well, you know, you got to do this or that, or don't wear the hat next time, whatever. But, you know, it's all kind of a production, and from the minute you get to the ballpark, right to the minute that you leave, there are accepted norms, and there are behaviors that are outside the norm that need to be changed or learned. And so that goes with having guys who are newer to the game. Although Ryan Presley's been around since 2013, he's pretty well known up here.
What does your gut say about Tyler Duffy usurping Presley's role? I know there's value in what Duffy can do across multiple innings, but at the same time, you do have to have somebody that can throw the eighth inning of a tight game. Again, I'm not talking about defined roles necessarily, but if it's 3-2 tonight and they're not going to Duffy, I mean, who the heck are they going to? Unless things line up with I'm trying to think of a lefty on their team. I know Carlos Beltran hits a switch hitter, but you know, Rogers could be that guy, but is Duffy in the mix now to throw those innings before Kinsler?
Well, I don't know night to night exactly this particular night, but in the larger scope, I like Duffy with the multi-inning. I like Duffy even, say, the ability, because he knows how to throw an inning, sit down, throw an inning, sit down. I like the idea of Duffy coming in, say, a 5 2/3 for the starter, finishing out the sixth, handling the seventh, and then maybe getting the first out of the eighth and getting you to a tough lefty.
Sure.
He can do that. Yeah. And that is something that the others have not shown the ability to do, because in many cases they don't have, just about all the cases, they don't have recent starting past, but experience. So Duffy's quite a nice piece for them. And the trade-off there is that you're really not going to want to use him on back-to-back days. That's why you ended up with Hector Santiago pitching in the 15th inning, and Duffy only came in when it got to the point where now you're jeopardizing Hector's start, and so Duffy got one out. Thankfully, they were going to go to Jimenez next. So I do like the Duffy experiment quite a bit, and that curveball. Cover Sports Illustrated this week, the explosion of the curveball in usage, and Tyler Duffy has pretty much the best curveball on the team. So you're just being deployed in a bullpen role, and very often multi innings, two plus, and maybe it'll get to the point where it's 9 full outs. But I just think there's such value, even if it's just 5 outs, finishing off the sixth, handling the seventh, getting you to the setup guys in the eighth. And, job well done.
I wanted to point out real quick, on Verducci's piece, he mentioned that, obviously more and more pitchers throwing the curveball, and that teams who have picked up on this are going away from sinker ballers. So I look at Gibson, I know you haven't touched on Gibson yet, but it seems like maybe teams are going away from him and maybe he's on the wrong side of this trend. Am I looking too far into that?
No, I mean, it's certainly a takeaway. And the numbers over the last year plus would would indicate that it's not trending well for Gibson for a variety of reasons: health, delivery, confidence, sequencing. I mean, I had Pat Neshek this spring in Phillies camp swear that Castro's pitch framing, because he worked with him in Houston, was going to help Kyle Gibson first and foremost. It's an interesting point that he'd be so specific, and the more I thought about it, I thought, yeah, Gibson's a guy with a small margin for error and that two-seamer with late movement and tough to handle, and Castro's very good at framing the two-seamer. Jimenez is good at it too, but Castro's much better. And although the data, like we said, hasn't vaulted him back to the top of the pitch framing yet, I think he's about 15th when I looked the other day, and he should be top five based on the last 3 years. So there should be more improvement as he learns the staff. But it hasn't really helped Kyle Gibson much yet, in part because he's lost some sink. Let's not forget, he was telling us that in the spring, and he has the sinker now is not fading and dropping the way it should. The horizontal break, the vertical break on that, if you really broke it down, I'm quite sure is on average pretty pedestrian now. His best pitch, a pitch that got him to the point where in 15 he was really good down the stretch in a pennant drive, is not reliable for him because of these Florida Baseball Ranch tweaks that he made. And he said it, he realized it right out of the chute that the way he was pronating now was something was different. He couldn't trust his sinker as much. So all that has dovetailed into a very trying period and really a career-threatening period for Kyle Gibson. I don't think that, by the same token, I think Kyle Hendricks is doing just fine with his pitch mix, which mm-hmm. does include two-seamers and plenty of people without overpowering fastballs. You don't have to be able to ram your two-seamer up there in the mid-90s or something like some guys can. Brandon Kinstler is also seeing, with his two-seamer, seeing the value of mixing in four-seamers so they have two different planes on the fastball alone to deal with. Maybe the exclusive sinker-slider guy is a thing of the past because you need to change eye levels. And one way you change eye levels is the four-seamer and the curve.
Well, so tell me I'm crazy, but I feel like when you look at Kyle Gibson physically and intelligence-wise and everything and stuff, you basically have Rick Porcello minus all of the execution. And I know Rick Porcello won the Cy Young Award last year, and I know how stat geeks look at him compared to like a David Price who has the strikeouts instead of the grounders. But I just think that Gibson has everything you could ask for in a pitcher. I mean, maybe not swinging strikes, but there's no reason he's not a back-end starter on the strength of his ground ball ratio. And I know that's not necessarily, again, like you said, the game might be trending away from that. But to me, it's just like, man, you feel like if he gets away, it would not be unreasonable for him to figure it out someplace else with just a small tweak here or there.
Yes, I don't think that's outrageous at all. And keep in mind that he needs a defense behind him. I know there's been a lot of talk about the defense being much better for the Twins, I think, in terms more so in the outfield defense. But certainly a guy without a lot of swing and miss and big ground ball rate is going to put a lot of pressure on his infield. Look back at Porcello, his first year in Boston, not very good, almost a 5 ERA, get a ton of hits. Just back in 2012, you get 50 more hits than innings pitched in Detroit. He was basically considered a flop, a disappointment, with similar draft status in Detroit until he had a very good year in 14, and then goes to Boston. But I think in the trade, I think that that's an interesting comp, and I think there's probably other comps that Kyle Gibson, with his savvy and commitment and accountability and all the things that have made the Twins as an organization so patient with him over the years, those things will do right by him if he stays healthy. We don't know what's really going on in the shoulder. We don't know what's going on in the back. And if he's, for a guy still in his late 20s, it was alarming to know mm-hmm. that there were, just even in 15, in 14, that there were starts where he could not sit down between innings, and he hit it very well by going in the tunnel. He was not broadcasting it down there in the dugout, but he would admit later on that back was an issue, and And so that's why when he does struggle like this and fans get angry and say 4A pitcher, I don't buy that. I think he's a major league, like you say, a solid four. And it's just a matter of pitch sequencing, and it's a matter of health, and it's a matter of the predictability for him of his most important pitch, which is that sinker.
So if you were to look down in the minor leagues, and if the Twins start making moves in the bullpen, there's no shortage of candidates who can come up and potentially help them. I say potentially because I think fans are always screaming for that panacea as far as bullpen. You know, someone that will come in and make everything look better because they're striking out 12 batters per nine down in AAA, even though they're not pitching multiple innings or anything like that. But if we were to look at some non-roster guys, I mean, Alan Bucinitz is on the list, Trevor Hildenberger, Nick Turley. Even if you look a little further down the list, DJ Baxendale, there are some guys, Aaron Sliggers, who could come up and help this team in some form or fashion. Who do you think is kind of edging their way towards the front if the Twins start kind of making some moves in that respect?
Well, I wouldn't leave out those guys at AA either who might just need a quick stopover in AAA. John Curtis,
yep,
who's mid-20s now and you know, healthy and has yet to allow an earned run.
Was he 90, throwing 98-99 with a fastball, I believe I've seen.
He's a big horse, and he had quite a career at Texas. He had health problems early on, but and then Melitakis also with a disjointed spring because of his side, but he's been outstanding. I talked to a scout who went through Chattanooga recently over the weekend, he was very impressed with both of those guys. Mm-hmm. Birdie, of course, that's too bad. It's a terrible shame for him and for this year's Twins that he needs Tommy John because he was lighting it up as he can, and he was showing command, and he was not, Brad Style told me, farm director, that was probably the best that they had seen him throw as a Twin prospect just recently. But so he's off the table. But there's there are guys who can help, and Chagua is not far away with his elbow issue. It's not Tommy John related. It's not UCL related. It's on the outside. So he's probably 6 to 8 appearances back in AAA once he's activated from being on the board again. He was very good in September,
right,
and then obviously wasn't quite right pitching this spring because his command was way off. But JT Chagua could be a second half piece, and of course, there's that warhorse Glenn Perkins, who's
right,
who's going to throw some live BP today, apparently out at Target Field, and then would probably need 20 to 30 days worth of rehab stuff, and then maybe that's a second half piece. But to your point, you just try to find a guy. All those are the right names. You try to find a guy who's found something in a span. It's pretty hard to be excellent out of the bullpen for all 6 baseball months. But you try to get the guys that are having that, you know, peak of confidence, peak of quality of stuff, and maybe you ride the 6 to 8 week period, and you let it happen in the major leagues instead of AAA.
I have seen some people talking about not being able to believe what Anthony Swarzak is doing with the White Sox, and again, it's been a good season, but or just saying, you know, the Twins had Swarzak and let him go, and I just feel like, well, you know, he was a full-time reliever for multiple seasons at the end of his Twins tenure, and then I really didn't think anybody was really crying over them outrighting him off the roster and letting him leave. I just feel like that's 2020 revisionist thinking at its worst.
Yeah, he's well-traveled since he left Twins world, and he was interesting once he got to the Yankees, and he went to Korea and wasn't so great in Korea, and then he went to the Yankees, and he said that they were the first ones. I wrote this last summer, that they were the first ones in his career that sat him down in the analytics department and showed him why he should be pitching up in the zone more. His stuff would play better with more four-seamers instead of two-seamers. He said all the Twins ever told me was keep the ball down, throw the sinker slider, like back to Tom's point.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that was, you know, Rick Anderson period. There's still a general sense that until this year, Twins pitchers were being, you know, the strike at the knees was really being pounded into their head, and it's only now that they're being freed up to try to use that top quadrant, especially if guys have the spin rate under four seam to justify it, to be sneaky with the four seamer up. And Swarzak apparently has, he's got a little more giddy up than I recall.
Mm-hmm.
He's however he's done it, he seems to be bringing a little more velo back to his early career stuff. So maybe he, you know, guys, those, like you say, these guys who he was long relief for the Twins for a number of years. So he would be a 50 to 60 pitch guy in a blowout there. In a few times they'd pop him into a close game that wouldn't go well, but good for him. I mean, he's a survivor. He's had to go through a lot. And I've always thought that he, you know, put in the work and tried to think through the game. And he, like he said, it was a revelation for him when the Yankees had him that they explained to him that it was pure, it was okay to work up in the zone. And that's what we're seeing throughout the game for people who have the ability to do that.
I have a random old friend take, and you can tell me what you think of it. I think that Tommy Malone, as a lefty, you know, can hang around for a very long time. I think whoever makes him a reliever, though, might have like a Randy Flores on their hands as far as a guy who can stay in the game till his late 30s just by being left-handed. Well, he's had the splits to the point where even as a starter, he's gotten lefties out at a fairly good rate. I just think he could be a second lefty in a bullpen for many, many years. And so I don't think his career is anywhere near done in that sense. I know he's struggled, obviously, pitching for the Mets as a starter. But I think if somebody puts him in the pen, he might be a guy that can bounce around for a while. I'm trying to think of some of the other lefties. Aaron Fultz was another one that bounced around for a while. The Twins had for a bit. Am I crazy, or do you see at least a guy who could at least be a decent lefty bullpen arm?
Hard to say because he's had so little time at it. And when the Twins would be amazingly out of spots in the rotation for him, and he'd have to sit out there in the bullpen, he didn't seem to really like it too much. He did have the famous save in Baltimore during the four-game sweep for the Twins in August 2015 when they were really on a roll, and he really enjoyed that. That was a kind of extra innings, goofy circumstances. But he'd have to drop down a little bit for me to start having dominance. I suppose that what you're saying, because you know the numbers better than anybody, I suppose he's been good against lefties, but I've never looked at him as a, even when they had those opportunities and need for him to sit out in the bullpen waiting for an opportunity, I never looked at him as a as nasty against lefties, because the stuff, like you say, is so the angle, the arm slot is pretty average, and he also has a pretty good cutter that when he's on, he can jam people on the right side with the cutter, as long as he's got if he's locating the changeup, which he has a good changeup at his best. But the problem is, again, his margin for error also razor thin, and he also tends to lose confidence, and his shoulder tends to seize up on him. That's another thing. He's not that durable. His shoulder, like you said, it's like clockwork as a starter, at least. By late July every year, he would need a break. He would have fatigue. So I don't know about Tommy being the kind of guy who could appear, you know, three straight days like a lefty, a situational lefty would need to. I think that that may be one of the reasons. So much of that it wouldn't work. So much of being a modern reliever is the ability to be available every day. Even if you don't get in, you have a lot of up and not ins that nobody likes, but it's a fact of the fact of life for those guys. It's about showing up the ballpark, and I wrote about this angle with Taylor Rogers this spring, and it's interesting that he's showing it at a young age, and I think it'll carry through. It's just not everybody has it. Even if you consider this certain guy a gritty competitor, a guy who prepares, all that stuff, it's still, there's such a premium on bouncing back and having the same quality of stuff day to day. By the third day, you know, I think Taylor said, you know, you got to drink an extra Red Bull because if you've worked the last 2 days, by that third day, especially if it's a day game after a night game, you're dragging. And you may need to go into that game in the seventh or eighth inning with the game on the line. And so the guys who can do that, who can keep getting to the post and being available and maybe up and not in, but still, you know, available. That's such a big thing. You hear Mulder say every day, well, I don't know. We have to wait till they go out and play catch, because they don't know until, you know, 5 o'clock, 5:30, whether even feeling okay to throw in a major league game. So the guys who can, day after day, three in a row, four out of five, they're the ones who pitch into their 40s.
What are you expecting out of Jose Berríos tonight? Obviously, three very good starts so far to start his season, at least his big league season, coming up after being very good at Rochester as well. But Houston, number one offense in baseball by weighted runs created plus. They just took over the Yankees, I think, in the last few days. it's obviously a difficult matchup, and probably part of the reason why they also have another long arm up here in Jason Wheeler in case things don't go well. But is your expectation that he can keep cruising? Is your expectation he's going to hit tough offense here? Or are you just kind of excited to sit back and watch him go to work against another strong test here in start number four?
Yeah, I'm not in the prediction game. If it were that simple, I'd be retired in Vegas. But it's there is something to watch with Brios. He had a good one at Houston last year when he had struggled at home, and then he went down there. And Carlos Correa is good buddy from Puerto Rico and a WBC teammate, and they get and Alex Cora is now the bench coach, the GM of Team Puerto Rico and WBC, who was there constant presence. He is the bench coach of the Astros. It's fun to see the little extra oomph that all that Team Puerto Rico is a special group. That they really, as we saw when the Tigers came in and Joe Jimenez gave up the home run to Vargas, Santiago was giving them a hard time. They have a constant group text going on throughout the year continuing. And you put Barrios out there, as you saw against Cleveland again with Lindor, you put Barrios out there against his WBC buddies, and you get another gear. And that's a little scary considering the gears that he's reached against Colorado and Baltimore yeah. and, of course, against Cleveland. So he's harnessing it better. But I would submit that he harnessed it pretty well last year at Houston and at Cleveland, two of his best, really maybe his two best starts of the year until the final day of the season at Chicago and Chris Sale. So that's just something to keep an eye on. I don't know that he's got everything figured out. I think the solo homers that he gave up in Baltimore, which is a bandbox, are something to keep an eye on. Two of them were on curveballs. There's also this thing where his four-seamer is getting swings and misses, as you've noted, and some of them are right down the middle, swings and misses, as MLB.com has noted, and it's something to watch. But one thing I pointed out the other day when I was invited on MLB Network, which was cool, although it's very hot out there, is that Barrios has increased his spin rate on the four-seamer from last year to this by about 8%. And it might not seem like a big deal, but if he's getting this invisible aspect to an elevated fastball that last year was getting pounded, maybe it is the Grant Dayton effect. Maybe it is the fact that he's added 160 RPMs on that for whatever reason. And even your boy Jimenez, your podcast guest, mentioned that there's something about the way Barrios is snapping the pitches off at the end, the finish to the pitch, the way the ball's rolling off, that could off the fingers. That could add to the spin rate. So that's something we need to explore a little more and see if this has staying power. But through three starts, plus 8% in the four-seamer spin rate, and I think any pitcher would like to have that kind of increase.
All right, before we let you go, I do want to ask you one thing. Last time you were on with us, you called from Cedar Rapids. You wrote a really great article about nutrition being emphasized throughout the Twins system. I first of all recommend people go read it on TwinCities.com. But for a little bit of a tease, what would you say was your main takeaway? Because obviously, reading Baseball Prospectus and following baseball Twitter for as long as I have, in addition to wages at the minor league level, people have said, quit feeding these guys peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Feed them complex carbs. Feed them juice. Get rid of the soda. Get rid of the McDonald's. And I think you really addressed that really well. What was your primary takeaway as you visited with the Colonels players?
Well, thanks. I think they've been enlightened and empowered as low minor league prospects, and in some cases, maybe just organizational guys. But that's so important and so smart. Twins are not the only team offering now catered meals home and away at that level in the Midwest League, but only about half the league is doing it based on my conversations with the Cedar Rapids Colonels people. And the players themselves, of course, love it. Kate Moran, who is a nutrition consultant for the Twins and has traveled throughout their system, and also she's based down in Naples, Florida. She met with the Twins major league group of going into the season to stress a couple of things, not just eating the right foods that are provided at the park, which now in the minor league level from A-ball all the way up are much better and much more sensible, but away from the park, late night eating, better choices there too. So Which any of us in the media should adhere to,
right,
but don't. These guys, as Hector Lujan, who throws 95 and good dude in their bullpen, explained, he said, "It's we got to treat our bodies like race cars. If you put good fuel in a race car, it'll take care of you. You put bad fuel in it, it won't." And so this is a pretty important topic for keeping these guys' performance levels up throughout the year. We talked already about recovery for bullpen guys. Anybody out there playing their first full season, several of them pointed that out, that they're well aware of the difference, what's going to be asked to go 140 games as opposed to maybe a summer at E-Town and after some extended spring. So good for the Twins, very wise. I would think that there'll be even more of that, but just education, but in a I guess, like I say, empowered, enlightened in a partnership way. That's a big word with Falvey and Levine, and,
yeah,
and letting these guys know that, we're still only going to get you the $25 a day meal money, but you're going to eat so well now, home and away, that, of course, on the road, you're going to be able to send that money or pocket it or do something wise with it. And if you do get a late night snack, it's not going to be a Big Mac. It's going to be something that's that your body can actually break down. So it'll be interesting to chart how that handles in terms of days on the DL, in terms of second half production. But it seems pretty wise as an initiative.
Do you guys, real quick, do you guys have any thoughts on Frank DeFord passing? I'm familiar with his work, and it's got to be kind of a tough day for a lot of people in the business.
Well, we're talking about nutrition here, Tom. But yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, I never actually one-on-one got to talk to Frank DeFord. I went to hear him speak when he came to North Carolina once. An interesting factoid that, everybody's All-American. He wrote the screenplay for that, and that was based around LSU. But the gray ghost. He wanted that to be at North Carolina, but they wouldn't give permission. That character is loosely based on Charlie Choo Choo Justice, a running back way back. Frank DeFord could outspeak any of us, and it's really heartening to see that how many people have come out and said what an influence he was in his humility and his generosity. Karen Krause, who I know from working at Opposite Papers in South Florida, said that as a young writer, she's at the New York Times as a fine feature writer, that she sent him some of her clips for some feedback, and he sent her back a 6-page typed letter of critique and encouragement. So that was the kind of guy Frank DeFord was. It's one thing to have the most talent of the group in your chosen field. It's another to have the most class. And when you combine the two, you're legendary.
Well, Mike, we are thankful for your collaborative partnership on this show and the synergy that we've created. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you at Target Field. You get to run through the shower. We'll see you there in a little bit. But thanks for joining us, everyone. For Tom Schreier, for Mike Berardino, I'm Brandon Warren. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.